Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Brad, and I'm an alcoholic. For those who care to join us, let's open the meeting with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the hall and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, would you please silence your cell phones? Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. This is our preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the steps discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing steps eight and nine, and I'd like you to please welcome our panel this evening. We have Ginger and Jason. And the first reading is from on page 80, and it's, the chances are that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely, sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and an exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him.
Me first? Okay, I'm Ginger. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, I wasn't, when I read this, it says the girl who understands. Well, I was the girl who understood. I liked married men because I was single. And so, I always made the excuse that I wasn't the one cheating. They were cheating, but I wasn't because I wasn't married. And so that was my rationale. And so there really wasn't a lot of, for this particular paragraph, for me, it was more about I had to make amends to the people around me, but it didn't have to do with this because I couldn't go to all the wives of, because I didn't know the wives of the husbands and stuff like that. So that wasn't, you know, my part. So that's what I've got.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jason. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jason.
My sobriety date is August 4th, 2013. My home group is West Ghent. We meet on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock on Princess Anne at St. Andrews. Hope to see you there. When I look through this paragraph, for me, the path of recovery, the main or one of the biggest obstacles was resentment I had against my wife, my ex-wife. Now, and when I did my first fourth step, my sponsor reminds me that the whole thing was about my ex-wife first. And, you know, she had trapped me in the marriage, and she wasn't any fun, and she was taking my money, and she didn't want me to drink. And all I saw were things that I felt she had done to me, and I was a victim. And so when this paragraph talks about domestic troubles and complicated relations and a worn-out wife, I can identify with that. I didn't see my part at all in the beginning, which made it really hard to make amends. But I drank a lot while I was married, and we used to have the same argument all the time. She would say, "You drink too much," and I would say, "This marriage is lousy." And that would be it. And then we'd have it again. "You drink too much, this marriage is lousy," over and over again, and never got past that. And it's possible that we were both right, but I wasn't able to... I wasn't able to contribute to problem solving or to having that communication. When I look back on it now, I was a horrible husband, and the fact that she was worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative, I would have told you she did a bunch of things wrong to me in the beginning. I would have sworn up and down. But I was unreliable, I was dishonest, I was inconsiderate in so many ways that now I understand why she was in that bad spot, and I chose to look at it from my perspective, and I was trapped, and I was going to drink. It justified my self-pity and my resentment, but I'm in a whole different place now where I can see my responsibility in this, that it's understandable that she was in that position. I was drunk a lot. I did not show up, or I showed up late. I remember the day that we moved in together in an apartment in D.C., we had some friends move us in. It was at the stage of my life where we'd all just kind of help each other move their stuff around and then go have beer afterwards. And so I think we finished at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and I went out and we drank until 3 in the morning, me and the movers. And this was on the first day that we were moving in together. And to me, it's just one example of my drinking made me a really horrible partner. All I chose to do was see how she was treating me and how it impacted me and see myself as a victim. But it really is horrible to be in a relationship with an alcoholic. And so understanding that the problem here is really I was not a good husband puts me in a situation where I can think about making amends. That's what I got.
Right. We are going to page 81. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this the best course to take.
At the end of my drinking, I was in a relationship, and the fact that he had to put me into rehabs and psych hospitals and pick me up, and when the cops came, you know, they you know, he would call the cops. I split my head open, and they would come to take care of me. And then they'd say to him, "You need to kick her to the curb. You know, she's going to take you down the tubes." And I can remember the policeman saying that, and I was like, "Who does he think he is?" You know, and the fact that as that relationship went on, and he was a great enabler, which was fine with me. Fortunately, I didn't end up on the street, but I really didn't. You know, when I got sober, I have to tell you, I was sober a while before I ever thought that I did anything wrong. I really felt I was a victim. And all these people, if they hadn't done what they did to me, I wouldn't have drank. There wouldn't have been a problem. And so I had to be sober a while. You know, I had done all the steps in my very first meeting when I saw them on the wall. You know, I read them and I finished them because, hey, there was nothing wrong with me. And when I put down the drink, I thought everything was going to be fine. And so for me, when I got sober in this, you know, and I was able to look at my part in this, I didn't think that I could hurt anybody else. If I wanted to drink and kill myself, what difference did it make to you? And that was my premise on everything. And in the later paragraphs, I mean, it was a lot of people that, there were a lot of people I devastated. And the fact that my relationship is now an amazing relationship, but that took a lot of work and a lot of time. So.
In my story, as I mentioned, I know there is a lot of wrong on my part with my ex-wife. Infidelity was not one of the issues we had. I used to actually, I was kind of proud of myself that I never had an affair, as if I was some kind of badge of honor. I think I was really in such pathetic condition most of the time while I was drinking that I wasn't really an eligible swinger, but... so I'm not sure I get halo or wings or anything for that. I was really alone. I was drinking alone in my apartment. I was sneaking the drinks. I was not out in the bar. And the harm that I did, the dishonesty, was not about the infidelity. It was about I desperately needed approval. I would say and do anything to get approval to make myself feel better about myself. And then I could never have a confrontation. I could never have an honest conversation because I was always afraid of aggravating her or pissing her off in some way. So I was just never honest. It's just a different kind of harm. But when I look at my amends and where the amends would do harm to others, and it's easy for me to want to use that as an excuse to do living amends or to avoid actually talking to somebody. I guess the most important thing for me is talking to my spiritual advisor or to a sponsor to understand what really are my motives. I think the best examples for me where I struggle with making amends, where I could hurt someone else, and trying to understand if I'm really thinking about it right. One is with my kids. So my kids are young. My daughter especially is 11 now. She was 8 when I stopped drinking. And so it's high on my list of people to make amends to. And in talking this through with my sponsor, in that situation, I don't think I would make the world a better place necessarily by trying to walk her through things that happened from the time she was 2 to the time she was 8. There I really am working on being reliable and honest and loving and considerate. And I do think, and maybe sometime in the future we'll talk about it more directly, but I don't want to do harm to her simply to move through this journey. I want to make amends for what I did wrong. And then the other experience, and I've seen this with others, is that I do sometimes think about calling ex-girlfriends so I can make amends to them. And I really have to think about the motives there, because I can't see really that someone I went out with a couple of years ago for maybe 3 months or 6 months, and I was hiding that I was drunk, and again, I was, you know, pretending to be whoever they needed so they would like me, and then I was afraid to disagree with them, and then I probably just disappeared. they probably have moved on. And when I want to make amends to them, I'm kind of thinking, oh, I guess I could call this person and I could say, you know, I'm sorry about the way I was, but I'm a lot better now. And what's going on with you? And to me, that's where I struggle with wanting to make amends when it may harm the other person and my motive is not great. And again, talking to my sponsor is the best way for me to sort through that.
The next reading is on page 82. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents for whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. He is like the farmer who came out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?"
I didn't realize exactly what a tornado I was. My sister, my little sister, and my mother, and all my family, my ex-husbands and all, my ex-husband, his family, we were all very, very close for a long time. And when my drinking started, those relationships all died away. I moved to New York City, and I was by myself, and I was single, and I was doing my thing. And as my drinking progressed and my drug use progressed, I basically just wouldn't call. Nobody knew where I was. They didn't know what I was doing. You know, my mother said, you know, she would call and I wouldn't talk to her. I wouldn't respond. And so she didn't know what was going on. And then I would have those drunk calls, you know, the ones that you make in the middle of the night when you're so loaded. And I would call people, and all that did was instill more worry and so forth. And I remember my mother, I had the cops called on me, and Kenny had called to have me arrested, and I had the cops arrest him instead. And after that happened, I called my mom for help because I no longer had car keys. I no longer had a place because everything, I lost everything. And so I called my mom for help, and she goes, "I'm done." She goes, "I don't care." But she called my sister, and so I went out to my sister's house, and I really hurt her a great deal when I was there. I was drunk the whole time, and I can remember the look of devastation when she put me back on a plane and said, "I don't want to see you again." You know, and things like that, you know, but that didn't bother me. I didn't stop drinking. You know, that wasn't of concern to me. And the fact that, you know, all these people that love us, we don't, at least for me, I didn't realize what I was doing to them. I thought I was only hurting myself. And so I was real good at saying I was sorry. You know, I said I was sorry all the time. And I'm sorry didn't cut it anymore. You know, they were done with that. And so I had to realize that all these people, but I wasn't ready to make amends. I was getting the willingness, but I wasn't ready yet. So.
Sobriety is not enough. I had a period of time when I was married when I went on, and I've said this before, on Anabuse, which I think of as the dry drunk, the ultimate dry drunk, where you're not drinking and you possibly are doing nothing else to have a solution in your life. And so I gave my wife over a year of being sober and nothing else, And that was not a good place to be. I was restless and irritable. I was not a good husband. And the absence of the alcohol from the house did not make things better, because the problems were a lot deeper, because I had no idea how to interact with another human being until I came to AA and learned to be honest and take responsibility for my actions. The tornado is it's a powerful metaphor. It's a powerful image. You know, you think of the destructive power. Whenever I see them, you know, on the Weather Channel or whatever, I just think it's amazing. It can just lay waste to a huge area. And I do think that my alcoholism did that kind of damage to the family. It was not just about, I like to think maybe I was just hurting myself when I was drinking, but I spent some time with my ex-wife. We were taking my son on college visits a couple of weeks ago, and I took a look at her, and I just had the thought that she really didn't bargain for what she got in terms of, she probably just wanted to get married and have a house and a family. And instead, she got the Jekyll and the Hyde. There were times that I was exactly what she wanted and a normal person, limited times. And then times when I was intoxicated or I was irritable, and she wound up with some kind of monster that she didn't bargain for at all. And the damage to the family and the household was broad. We moved several times. And I look back on it now and I realize that I like to move all the time because there's a chance that I could leave my problems behind and make a new start. And maybe at least I'll have new problems if the old problems don't follow me. So I've been moving my whole life. But she hadn't, because she didn't run from her problems and she didn't have the same kind of problems I did. And we never talked about that when we got married. But once we got married and my problems got worse, we had to move a couple of different times. And I never thought about the damage that that did to her, how difficult it was for her moving to a new place. At one point, I had a job where I was traveling a lot, and my excuse was the traveling was making me drink. So we had to move someplace so that I could have a job where I didn't have to travel. Which did not actually make me stop drinking, but it did uproot her from home. She was near her family, and we moved to another state. I took a new job, and then her family moved up near us, and we're all relocated. But I'm still there, and my problems are still there. And so I flame out again, and I get fired from a job, and then we've got to move again to a totally different part of the world. And so I'm ripping her up, and she's the kind of person who wants to have roots, and I don't think about it. And my kids are moving too. My son was just doing his college essay, and he talked about how many different schools he went to when he was young. But it wasn't because I had to change jobs. I wasn't in the military. I wasn't being transferred. It was because I had to run, or I was trying to run. And so that damage, I had no idea what I was, the damage I was doing, but now I can see that it was like a tornado.
Thanks.
All right, and we're going to move to page 83. Yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone.
I remember when I was, this time when I was trying to get sober, because you know, the whole time I was in this on and off relationship with this man, he would take me and get me sober. I would go in and then, but it was like everybody wanted me sober but me. And I would leave the hospital and go get a bottle of booze, you know, because I'd feel better and I'd start drinking again. And there was no reason for me not to drink. And so over a period of time, you know, my drinking progressed and got so bad, and I would try to stop and couldn't stop. But this relationship I was in, I remember he was trying really hard to protect me, and he wanted to move into my apartment. And I said, no, you can't move in, because it's something I'd wanted my whole time. You know, I loved him. I wanted him to be there, but I didn't want him in my house because then I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. I mean, I was already hiding liquor from me, but I didn't want anybody there to see it. And so, you know, there was a whole lot of stuff that went on that was really, really crazy. And then when I, this time when I got sober, which my sobriety date is May 1st, 1996, when I called for help, it was me. I had reached my bottom. But when I said I was getting sober, nobody believed me, you know. He told my mom, oh, Ginger's sober. And she's not going to stay sober. Nobody even talked about it. You know, I didn't speak to my mother or my sisters until I was 2 years sober because they wanted nothing to do with me. They didn't believe I was going to get sober. And I was actually a little bit afraid to say I was going to get sober because I had tried to get sober so many times and I hadn't. You know, I'd just gotten drunk again. And so I had to, you know, it took me a long time to get ready to look at them and say, here's the person I've become. You know, I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and I had to face that. And I had to realize, you know, I was complaining to somebody, and they said, Ginger, if you don't change, your sobriety date will. And so that meant I had to work on me. And I was so incredibly selfish that I really thought that everything else, as long as I didn't drink, everything would be fine. But I have to tell you, I was still throwing things in my house. I was still screaming at people. I mean, my mouth was horrible, and the things I said to people were just terrible. And, you know, I remember Danny Boy looking at me and saying, Ginger, you know, if you don't start changing your behavior and becoming the woman you want to be, you're never going to stay sober. You know, you're never going to stay sober. And so I had to start looking seriously at doing the steps, you know, and doing what I was going to do. But, you know, when I got to eight, you know, the reason I jump around on this is because by the time I got to 8 and 9, you know, I had already done my 4th and 5th, but I put this stuff off because I wasn't making amends to anybody. And that was, you know, it was very hard to have the willingness to tell them that I was sorry, that I was wrong, and how much I had hurt them. And I didn't want to face them. I didn't want to look at them and have to tell them that. And so that's, you know, it says clean house with family. That took time. You know, that wasn't something that just happened. I had to change myself and show them that I was serious about my sobriety before anybody wanted anything to really do with me. You know, they weren't just going to say, okay, Ginger, you're sober. You know, I wasn't drinking, but I had to learn how to become a different person, and that took time. So
it's like a lot of people, it seemed to me that my ex-wife should trust me as soon as I said really emphatically, I'm done drinking. And now that I look back honestly at it, as Ginger said, I wanted to stop drinking and I couldn't for a long time. So there are many, many events that took place over a long period of time where I promised all the time I would stop drinking, I would only have a couple. And so I earned the level of distrust that I had. And my drinking, I drank the whole time that I dated and then married my wife. And in the beginning, we were just partying. And we lived in D.C. and we were just out of school and everybody was going out. It seemed to me everybody was going out. Maybe some people were going home, but we were going out every night or many nights, and we'd go out to happy hour and we'd have some beers and it was fun, and we'd play darts or pool. And what I learned was that for her, it was just fun. And then she fell in love, she got married, she's having a family, that was, she was moving on. But for me, I was always thinking, this is my life. This is a way of life. This is the only way I know how to live, is being intoxicated all the time. And so the disconnect started to emerge when I realized that this was not a phase for me. This was the way I live. This is the way I exist. And for her, it was, yeah, we were partying and this was fun, but it's not fun anymore. You're not fun anymore. We don't know whether I'm going to, how much I'm going to drink, or whether I'm going to get in a fight with somebody or an argument at the end of the night, or lose something, or try to drive, or insult somebody. And so the fun period moved into the not fun period, but I still didn't want to quit. At the end, when I wanted to quit, when I knew that alcohol was ruining my life, I didn't know how to live without it, because I just never felt good if I wasn't intoxicated, if I didn't have some anesthetic on my brain. But eventually, it was kicking the heck out of me. And so I was starting to lose everything that mattered to me, including all of my self-respect. And so I wanted to quit, and I never thought I was an alcoholic until that point, and I wanted to quit, and I couldn't. And I didn't know what to do about it. And it took me a decade or more to figure out where to ask for help, really. I was going to say figure it out, but all I figured out was who to ask for help and how to follow along with all of you. But during that decade when I wanted to quit and I couldn't, we went through just about everything in the book in terms of I'd only have a couple, I'd only have beer, it'd only be on certain days, and I could never stick to it. You know, I really hate the part in the book where it says try some controlled drinking, because I just don't see it. I never, you know, the idea of leaving something unfinished was not. In fact, I wouldn't even leave your drink unfinished most of the time. I would be finishing other people's. And so now I'm in a really dark place because I can't stop. And I know that she's more and more upset and she's going to take the kids and I have to stop, but I can't. So I do make a lot of promises. And I mean it when I make the promises. And that's, I think, where you earn the distrust, because you can look at someone with all the earnestness in the world and say, I will not drink again, or I will not drink like this again. And the next day or the next weekend, she'll catch me, we'll be at a party, and I can only have two drinks, so I'm going to find a way to get a third or a fourth in when she's not looking, and then I'll turn and she's there and she can see me at the bar. And again, I know and she knows that I couldn't do what I said I was going to do, that I couldn't keep my word. And so that trust, that loss of trust and that skepticism is so deep that it's you just can't come in and say I'm done and really expect someone to believe you. But living these principles over a period of time and becoming the person that we're, I think God wants us to be as we work the steps, I found that the trust comes back very quickly when you're doing the right thing. It doesn't come back when you're begging them to trust you, please trust me, really, let me do what I want. But when I can contribute to the relationship, at least being honest and considerate and productive and tolerant, loving and tolerant is the big thing for me, all of a sudden there is trust that comes up that I didn't even notice. I can look back now and say, my ex-wife trusts me. She doesn't seem to think that I'm going to drink, and she doesn't seem to think I'm going to endanger the kids. And there was a long time when she really was afraid anytime I was with them, I would be drunk. Would I drive, which I have, or would I not be able to respond if they had a need? A profound fear that I think really rattled her, as it should have, and as I'm very, very sorry about. But that's gone now. And so we can be together and she can let me take the kids. Now we'll go. Used to be she'd want to watch me with the kids. Now she'll bring them to the airport, hand them over at the curb, and let me go and not smell my breath and not breathalyze me and, you know, give me any kind of sobriety test. And some of that, I think, is by living the principles and having her see that I'm a different person. Because we have younger kids, we're still in a lot of family situations together. And I was in one this weekend, two weekends ago. My nephew had a bar mitzvah, and my little sister invited my ex-wife because a lot of family would be there. And these are her nephews who are in the family. And so we're there. And my ex was needling me on a couple of things. She didn't like what I wore, my dress code. She doesn't get to pick anymore. She used to. And she didn't like what my son wore, which I approved of. And that used to really tick me off. And I know how little it is, but I'm an alcoholic. And so I want to be in control, and I feel insulted, and what did I do wrong? So when we were married and she'd lay out the clothes, or she'd give me the look when I'd come down the stairs to go out that I should go back and change, I'd be really pissed. I could be pissed for days about that. And so she's given me a hard time about my wardrobe and my son's wardrobe, and my parents are there. And afterwards, my dad said, you know, you took that pretty well. It really didn't seem to bother you. And now when she says something that, you know, maybe I don't agree with, I can just kind of roll with it. She's doing what she needs to do, but I don't have to lash out. I can just kind of let it roll over me. And because we can interact in a non-toxic way and I can be respectful and kind and tolerant, now she trusts me. And so I always wanted it to happen fast, and it wouldn't happen fast. But then when I started doing the things I'm supposed to do, it happens before I knew it.
All right, the next reading is on page 83. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. And there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone.
When I finally made my amends to the... I mean, there were people in my life that I had made amends to that were just people that I had wronged and stole from and lied to and, you know, that kind of thing. And those were not hard amends to make. But the one amends that I wasn't going to make was to my mother. That was the one that was not going to happen because I was still a victim as far as she was concerned. And I mean, as far as I was concerned. And, you know, the thing is what... The longer I stayed sober and I didn't drink, I couldn't live with all that guilt and shame and all that stuff that was inside of me. It was horrifying to me of the person I'd become. You know, when I didn't have the liquor and the drugs to push all this stuff down, and I looked at what I had become, I couldn't live with that without alcohol. And I knew the only way I was going to get sober and stay sober was to sit down and actually admit what I had become. And I remember I had my mom and my sister and everybody, I had Kenny invite them to Florida, to the condo in Florida, to come for Christmas so I could make amends to them. And, you know, they were very wary of coming to my house, you know, because I had had them for Christmas before. And I didn't remember it, but I had had them numerous times. And so when I sat down and talked to, because I remember my mother's very, very clearly, and she said to me, you know, the only thing I want is for you to stay sober. That is the one thing that I want. She said, all that stuff, she said, that's all okay. All these things that I thought were going to happen, you know, and all this anger and everything. And when I told her what I had felt like, you know, all the things that were bothering me, of course, had to come out. And, you know, she said, Ginger, you're right. There are things you're right about. And, You know, and it was like we talked for the first time. And that was an amazing thing to me, to have that kind of response and to have her look at me and say, Ginger, it's okay. It's okay. And she had put, you know, my dad was the alcoholic and she had put up with this behavior before. And so she wasn't somebody who was willing to do that again. And my sister wasn't either. And but both of them, you know, people did learn to trust me. Like he said, it wasn't easy. They didn't, every time I left the house, they didn't know if I was coming back. You know, nobody expected to see me. And when I got back on time and I was responsible and I was doing these things, they were like, whoa, you know, what's happening? They didn't know. And, you know, I wanted sobriety more than anything in this world. And I wanted to stay that way. And, you know, the thinking about the amends and the willingness to make the amends and all that stuff was such a big deal. And then when the action, when I finally did it and I took the steps, it was a piece of cake. You know, it was like, and the weight that was lifted off my shoulders, you know, somebody said, Ginger, we're all human. You know, the people out there have done the same thing. You know, if it's got a name for it, somebody's done it before. So, you know, it wasn't that I was doing all this unique stuff. It was the fact that I had to admit to doing this stuff and the way I had hurt them. And, you know, I didn't get to make, one of the ones that I didn't, my dad, when he was dying, I didn't go see him. I was in New York City, and that would take too much time. And I went down just before he died. And he didn't get sober. And I never got to tell him how much I wish he had, you know, how much, you know, I was so grateful that I had found AA. And so I wrote a letter. You know, I did get to write a letter to him and everything because he died. And so I didn't have that amends. And I stole from an employer that I had, and he had died too. And so, you know, I gave money to different places for charity, you know, those kind of things that we're trying to make up. Because some of them, there's people that I don't even know people that I hurt. But probably they were, you know, more along the lines of being alcoholics. The people I hung around with were not the cream of the crop. So, you know, I had, that's the person I had become, you know, that, you know, other people didn't want to be around me because when you're a falling down drunk, it's very embarrassing for normal people to have you in their life. And so, you know, it's amazing to me that God's grace worked through me and filled that hole inside where I was okay to admit to myself what I had become, because I knew God forgave me. You know, that was the one thing. I knew God forgave me for all this stuff. Me forgiving myself, and, you know, and everybody said, you know, Ginger, it doesn't matter. They don't have to forgive you, but you have to make your amends. And the very definition of amends is to change. And so the person who's sitting here today, thank God, is not the person that walked into the room as Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that much I know. So,
I can talk about my experience delaying in making amends and finding reasons why I can't make amends, but I really need to start with taking action through the steps is what's changed my life. It's helped me learn how to live peacefully on the earth without alcohol and without being a jerk all the time. So I can share the things the amends I was afraid to make, because for me, there's not a lot of amends I just can't make. I think that I'd like to characterize some amends as being impossible to make, but at least in my case, there's really nothing I can't make amends for. There are things I don't want to make amends for, or I'm not ready to make amends for, and it's nice if I can describe them as things that are impossible to do, but or I shouldn't do. But for me, there's a lot to be learned in the reluctance to make amends, because I'm in this thing for good now. I want to be part of the AA experience. I want to stay sober. I want to be here. I'm glad to be here. So then why am I, do I really rebel against doing some of this? There is something in me that's not right when that happens. And so the first amend that I struggled with, maybe the most important, was with my father. The consistent thing about the amends I don't want to make is that I resent the person. I have self-righteous indignation. I see their side of the street and I can't let go of it. Even if they had a small problem and I had a huge problem, if I'm hung up on what they did and they should have done, I can't make amends, and then I can't have this experience. I can't heal the relationship. I can't move on and grow. But I was always convinced that my dad, probably like a lot of people, it doesn't even matter the circumstances, just didn't do well enough as a dad in a bunch of ways. And so I'm indicting him. He wasn't a good enough dad for X, Y, and Z reasons. And so I'm so mad, I'm not going to tell him that I'm sorry. And it wasn't until I'm a parent and I'm honestly assessing my own life, I see that, you know, parents are not perfect. People are not perfect. And so my dad made some mistakes, probably. I'm sure he was doing the best he could. And I make some of the same mistakes, some different mistakes. And so coming to terms with the fact that I am judgmental and self-righteous, usually just to cover up the fact that I feel insecure and I'm afraid, I'm finally able to push myself to make amends to my dad. I understand that his side of the street, it's not really even that important. It's not important in this context, and it never was very important. And so I can say to him, I know I scared the heck out of you for a long period of time. In fact, there was quite some time they didn't really think I was going to live. My dad told me, you know, they were always afraid I wouldn't make it at all. And I think about the horror of that as a parent. But I was able to say to him, I know that I scared you guys constantly, and that you gave me so many opportunities and all I did was scare you, and I what can I do? Is there anything I can do? And my dad said, you could call me every once in a while. And I've heard stories like this, that people hear that you're worried about making the amends, or especially in the family, and all they really want is for you to be present and sharing their life. And so now most Sundays, I try every Sunday to call my parents. And I did this Sunday, but not every Sunday, but that wasn't very much to ask for. And so putting that off was nonsense, but it was really about my own obsession with what I thought my dad had done wrong, because I was being so judgmental. And the other one is with my boss, my current boss and my previous boss where I work. Same thing. I am judging them. They are not a good boss. They don't treat people well. They tell me what to do. That's my least favorite with the boss. They tell me what to do. They boss me around. They expect me to come to work. All these things that I... And so I'm constantly judging them. And behind it's always my fear of being inadequate, or maybe of being rejected by them. But I can't get out of my own way and make amends and have this experience. And so I find that I go to work and I'm resentful day after day, and not every day, all day, but it's a very common experience for me, is being resentful at work. And it's usually triggered by my boss, and I wonder why it's not going away, but I'm not willing to make amends because I'm so busy judging them and continuing to add to my list of things that they do wrong pretty much every day. And it's not helping me. It's not helping them. And so I passed my 10-year anniversary at work about 2 months ago, and I had been putting off amends to my boss and to my former boss. And so I decided that somehow it made it easier for me to be able to say, hey, it's been 10 years. I just wanted, it made me kind of nostalgic. I was thinking about some things. And I was able to say to my current boss, when I got arrested, when I finally hit my bottom, I left work on a Friday in August of 2013. And I didn't go back for 4 months. I just went AWOL. And I was convinced he was the worst boss in the world. I mean, I still was 2 months ago. I was making his inventory. And But he saved my livelihood. He kept the job open for me for 4 months. And so finally I'm able to, you know, to change the lens a bit and see that he's done a lot for me, not everything perfect. And so I was able to say to him, I was a really unreliable employee. You gave me a cool, interesting job with security for my family, and you couldn't count on me whether I would come into work functioning well or, as it turns out, not coming at all for a long time. And when I did that, I really disrupted work, or whether I would be irritable and disruptive in the workforce. And, you know, I wish that hadn't happened, and I'd like to make that up to you if I can. Is there anything I can do? And what he said to me was, all he wants is for me to be well. And he asked me, if I'm struggling again, tell him before things spiral out of control so that he can help me. And that's all he wanted. He just didn't want to get the call afterwards, you know, and wanted to have a chance to help, because he has been trying to help me. And again, this is a person I'm judging for all these horrible things who really never did anything. And until God enters my life through the steps, I can't see this thing with the right lens. And I think even more poignant for me was making amends to my first boss where I work. And he hired me. We had worked together a long time ago. I got fired from my previous job for insubordination. This is when I was dry, when I was taking the antabuse. And believe it or not, I had trouble getting along with people. I was argumentative, and I alienated my coworkers apparently, and disrespectful and belligerent. I was horrible. And so they fired me, which, you know, I can imagine being fired from the military for being insubordinate, but from corporate America, it doesn't happen very often. And but I earned that one. And so all of a sudden, I'm out of work, and I've got no explanation how I lost my job. I've got no good explanation. And I think, you know, those of us who have lost jobs, sometimes it's in awkward circumstances, and I need to find a job to support my family, and I've got no good story to tell. And so this guy gives me a job. He basically says, I trust you. I know you. You've had a rough time. And so he gives me a job and rebuilds my career. And then I basically bitch about him for the next 4 years after he's hired me. And I tell people he's not good at his job and I should have his job. And I'm terrible. And so on my 10th anniversary, I was able to make amends to him and say, I know I was unreliable, but more importantly, you did something really nice for me, and I did not appreciate it, and I wish I had, and I'd like to make it up to you. And for him, all he really said was, I really appreciate you saying that. I'd never said to him that I really didn't respect the gift that he gave me. And he said he never thinks about it, and again, that delay was silly, and let's not delay in our amends.
All right, our last reading is on page 83. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
You know, it's funny because it's sort of like this, up to this point, it's like this horror story with all this stuff that went on. And when I got done with all my amends and so forth, I did feel a new freedom and a new peace. But the most amazing thing about being in Alcoholics Anonymous is the fact that over the years I've been sober. You know, I got married in AA. I got proposed to in an AA meeting at my home group, the Saturday morning brunch bunch. I actually got to take care of my mother for years before she died. I just got to take my sister to Hawaii last year, the one that didn't speak to me. I got to take her with me, and we had this incredible trip together. And, you know, and what was amazing to me, there was an amends that I hadn't even thought about. And it was, and we were sitting down to dinner, and I said to her, you know, I have to tell you, I have to make an amends for this. And when we were little, this just shows you that selfishness and self-pity, you know, that whole thing. When I was young, before I ever picked up my first drink, my sister was very quiet, and she had a dog, and the dog was everything to her. And I looked at her and told her that that dog didn't love her. And that ate at me and ate at me and ate at me. And I looked at her at dinner and I said, you know, I have to tell you that I am so sorry that I ever said that. And I know how much that hurt you. And, you know, I hope that I live long enough to make this up to you and to do the things that, you know, would make you feel like, you know, you could forgive me. And she goes, yeah, she says, you were really a bad kid. And I was like, yeah, I guess I was, you know, but it was like, and she, you know, but that kind of stuff, you know, to have the, to be able to do that, what, that was an incredible gift to me, you know. And and my mom said before she passed, she was, you know, I scrapbook, and I have all my AA anniversaries and my medallions and everything in the scrapbooks. And she said to me, you know what, Ginger, if you hadn't gotten sober, I wouldn't be sitting here today. And those are the gifts of doing these steps and doing them thoroughly and being able to get these people that you have, you know, devastated with your behavior and get to make a living amends to them and show them, you know. And my mom said to me, she said, I'm so grateful you've become the girl that you could always be. And that's all I ever wanted, you know, was for her and my parents to be proud of me. And so Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that, and the grace of God. You know, he came in and saved me. And, you know, the gratitude of my heart is just so amazing for steps I didn't want to take and taking them anyway. What a gift. What an incredible gift sobriety is. So thanks.
For me, I think I pretty simply can say what my life looked like before and after this journey. Before I bottomed out, I was consumed with bitterness and resentment and self-pity. I was convinced I wasn't getting from the world what I deserved, that people were doing me wrong, my wife, my employer. After going through this experience, it's exactly the opposite. I can see all the good that they have, both of them have done. That resentment has lifted, and I do feel some peace. And Thanksgiving Day, I will be at my ex-wife's house, and her parents will be there, and I'll go in, and my mother-in-law will give me a hug, and that's a gift. I go from my first four-step being all about my ex-wife to being able to walk into that house. And AA has taught me how to live. It saved my life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, you guys. Can we show a round of applause for Ginger and Jason? We will now pass the Seven Tradition Basket. The Seven Tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the Seven Tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local offices, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Are there any AA-related announcements? Jim?
The Hey, Jim. Hey, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Ralph. 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 Tuesday, Google will be open all day, Thanksgiving Day, Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, from 5:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. If you're sending your food there with us, there'll be a meeting every hour and a half, hour meeting, half hour meeting. So you're all welcome.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, Ralph.
My name is Ashton. I'm an alcoholic.
Ashton.
Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Would home group members please raise their hands? All right, newcomer, is there anyone here in his or her first 30 days of sobriety? If so, would you please introduce yourself by your first name? This is not to embarrass you, just so we can welcome you. We do have literature available on our literature table over there. The books have a charge. The pamphlets are free. Sponsorship. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. Anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship in AA, I will be up here at the table after the meeting and come up here with any questions you may have. All right, smokers, please use the butt can outside and please stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. In closing, can we show a round of applause for our panel tonight? And thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on 22nd and Colonial Avenue. And could someone please read the... All right, thank you.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
David.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. And we'll now close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father,
Who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not to temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Stay. Just stay.